When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code SPOTIFY to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code SPOTIFY at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code SPOTIFY.
This is your last chance to enter the Ohio Lottery's Fun Turns 50 promotion. Score $3,500 and two tickets to the epic party at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, where you could win part of another $400,000 in cash prizes. Enter the new 50th anniversary scratch-off or $50 worth of eligible non-winning $5 or $10 scratch-offs and My Lotto rewards through the Ohio Lottery app. Hurry up! The last entry deadline is May 13th. Lottery players are subject to Ohio laws and commission regulations. Play responsibly.
Imagine being the first person to ever send a payment over the internet. New things can be scary, and crypto is no different. It's new, but like the internet, it's also revolutionary. Making your first crypto trade feels easy with 24/7 support when you need it. Go to Kraken.com and see what crypto can be. Not investment advice. Crypto trading involves risk of loss. Cryptocurrency services are provided to U.S. and U.S. territory customers by Payward Ventures, Inc. PVI DBA Kraken. Visit PVI's disclosures at Kraken.com/legal/disclosures.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello and welcome to New Books Network. My name is Roland Clark, and it's my pleasure to be speaking today to Dr. Alex Drace Francis, who's Associate Professor of Modern European Literary and Cultural History in the Department of European Studies at the University of Amsterdam. Alex has published widely on European cultural and social history in the 18th and 19th centuries, with particular reference to Romania and the Balkans. He's also worked on broader questions of travel writing and cultural identities in Europe with a huge bibliography under his belt. His latest book is A Venture into Food History, focusing on what the title calls a Romanian national dish. Alex, for those of our listeners who've never tasted it, exactly what is mamăligă?
Thank you, Roland, for that kind introduction. Yeah, mamăligă. We're here to talk about mamăligă. It's a nice word, isn't it? I hope you agree. Yeah. People know about spaghetti, people know about tortilla, people know about papadums, people know about potatoes, and mamăligă is a nice word, kind of in that ballpark of special foods around the world, but maybe it's a lot less known than those previous examples. So yeah, in some ways mamăligă is easy to describe. It's a kind of mash or porridge or cake. There's slightly different ways of describing it, and the ingredients are incredibly simple. As a Scottish person, then I make porridge with oats and water. If I was a Romanian person, I would make mamăligă with cornmeal flour and water. Yeah, so ground maize meal boiled with water and stirred vigorously. Yeah. Having said it's easy to describe, and I don't think it's too difficult to make if you've got a little bit of elbow power, it's quite hard to translate. Some people make an analogy with Italian polenta, which is, of course, very well known, also made with corn flour and with cornmeal and with hot water and stirred and boiled. Polenta kind of has a little bit different associations. Yeah. Although originally I would say polenta is very similar, people often feel that mamăligă is very specific, and it's often used a little bit in shorthand to refer to Romanian cultural issues. Yeah. So yeah, on the one hand, a simple task which could take a couple of lines, a few lines in a cookbook, or it's a very complicated problem which requires further explanation.
Because it's not just a Romanian national dish, it's a Romanian national identity in a lot of ways. This is a really fun book to read, and it looks like it was fun to write as well. Just to quote one sentence from the introduction, in some periods, mamăligă boiled steadily on the stove of history or was even stored quietly on the pantry shelf. At others, it was vigorously stirred by war, disease, exploitation, and tyranny. It was subjected to territorial slicing, and during more than one moment of revolution, the dish was in danger of exploding. This is a book that's chock full of puns and playfulness, alongside some brutally erudite and careful scholarship. but it's also a really serious topic. Besides the appendix dedicated to understanding the etymology of six different types of six different words for Mamaliga in Romanian, what's the big argument that you wanted to get across in this book?
Thanks again, Roland. Really interesting question. Yeah, I think many people who've studied a little bit of East European history or looked into questions of modern Romania, they might think of it in terms of a history of heroes and villains. Yeah, to quote the title of a book by a colleague of ours, Maria Bucur. Yeah, you have villains like Ceausescu. You have monarchs, you have bandits, you have communists, you have fascists. Yeah, it's a really kind of event-based, people-based approach to the national story, the national history. Yeah, some of my ideas in this book come from wanting to take a little bit more of a long-term approach. Yeah, to look at actually older trajectories and to do it very much from a cultural history point of view. I was trained as a literary and cultural historian, but I'm also very interested in social history. And I think food is kind of one way of getting into some of these cultural problems in a little bit of a deeper way. Yeah. There's a good tradition of writing about food internationally, yeah, and there's an interesting tradition of commodity history, looking at, say, you know, how cod changed the world, or you know, what is the contribution of salt to the development of modern Europe. Yeah. There's also good work by anthropologists looking at the tomato or the potato, yeah, or particular national dishes. You know, what is the position of the curry in modern British society? My colleague here in Amsterdam, Elizabeth Butner, has written on that topic. So you have something which may be an informal part of the culture, yeah. Little, you know, dishes that people make, and they have some kind of emotional attachment to them, to it. It has certain meanings within the culture. So yeah, as you say, you can approach it as a fun problem, but you can also approach it as a question of economy, of social development, of social change. Yeah, in some ways it's a little bit provocative. You know, did Mamaliga actually have a history? You know, I found when I was starting to research the book that there were loads of mentions of Mamaliga. Lots of people, everyone recognizes Mamaliga who knows a thing or two about Romania, and there are quite a lot of informal popular histories. There's some nice newspaper articles. There's some very good cookbooks. There's some wonderful recent work on material culture and social change in Romania and Southeast Europe. Colleagues in Romania have done excellent work on luxury and fashion. There's a really good volume by a couple of Romanian scholars, Angela Gianu and Violeta Barbu, called Earthly Delights, Cultures and Economies of Food in Ottoman and Danubian Europe. Yeah. So there's been a really good school, in fact, of paying attention to material culture and social change. Yeah. But I found, in fact, there was more to say about Mamaliga. Yeah. I was interested in the fact that it wasn't one of the principal ingredients. Cornmeal comes from maize, and maize, as we know, is not a European plant. So there was a kind of history to be told there. You know, how did this come to be perceived as the Romanian national dish, both by insiders and by outsiders? Yeah. Looking into this question, I actually found more than I expected, lots of untapped sources, lots of different ways of looking at it. And it's also fun to range across different types of sources. So you have kind of formal documents from official authorities looking at maize, but you also have cultural representations in folklore, in cinema, yeah, in literature, and so forth. Yeah. So I use it really as a way of taking a new approach to existing questions of Romanian national development, but also hopefully trying to compare those with developments in other parts of the world.
And a lot of the book is dedicated to the history of Mamaliga and how Mamaliga created modern Romania. But you mentioned a second ago literature and cinema and folklore. Can you say something about what role Mamaliga has played in Romanian cultural production, either in the past or today?
Yeah, sure. I can certainly say a few things about that, and I did say a few things about that in the book. It was actually when I was trying to get to grips with the question, and as I mentioned, you know, despite this excellent tradition of material culture history, I was also interested in social attitudes to Mamaliga. Yeah. Any staple dish has certain connotations of social status. Yeah. One dish might be codified as an elite dish, you know, others might be a poor dish. I've mentioned porridge in the Scottish case. You know, that was historically the food of poor people, but then it becomes a national identity symbol. Yeah. These are things which are kind of a little bit awkward to document. Yeah. Anthropologists have talked about cultural intimacy, which is a concept coined by Michael Hertzfeld. And cultural intimacy refers to things which people know about, but they don't necessarily talk about explicitly, perhaps precisely because it's assumed that everyone's familiar with them in a little way. Yeah. And really for this reason, although I think it's a historical narrative, I think looking at literary and cultural and cinematic sources can be very helpful, not because they tell us, you know, the true meaning of Mamaliga, but they give a certain sense, indications and so on. You know. So you see Mamaliga featuring in a tiny way in contemporary Romanian film, or you have a whole lot of proverbs and sayings about Mamaliga. One thing I would notice is that these are not always necessarily positive. Mamaliga is remembered with affection in some ways, perhaps particularly among Romanian diaspora communities who remember Mamaliga as something belonging to their homeland, comfort food, a source of security, a source of memory, family memories, and so forth. Yeah. But in fact, looking at ways in which it's codified in elite or popular culture, the associations are not always positive. So if I were to say to you, I wouldn't dream of saying this to you, I'm going to make Mamaliga out of you, yeah, which in Romanian, am să fac cu tine Mamaliga, yeah. That means I'm going to beat you up. You know, I'm going to beat you into a mush, yeah. Or if I say of somebody else, you know, he's only good for cutting Mamaliga with, yeah. E bun de tăiat Mamaliga, yeah. That means he's not very good for anything, yeah, because Mamaliga is soft and mushy. You can cut Mamaliga with the most rudimentary tool, yeah. So it has a little bit these associations, which could be ones, as I say, of affection or sentiment, but a little bit this kind of awkward, perhaps stigma associated with Mamaliga. Yeah, it's the kind of bottom line of society, yeah, a subsistence level of existence. Yeah. So you get a little bit of a contrast. And I think the historian, you know, can look at literature, folklore, and film as kind of clues to a more complex history. Here in Amsterdam, we have a school of image studies, which spends a lot of time looking at representations of stereotypes. And in some ways, it's the opposite approach from the conventional archive-based historian, yeah, who looks for secrets in dark cupboards. Yeah. Cultural historians often look at the surface of things. Yeah. This is what a professor in Amsterdam, Joop Leersen, calls hiding in the popcorn. Yeah. This is a title of his work, Study of National Ideology and How It Survives into the 21st Century. Yeah. If we look at popcorn, if we look at kind of popular productions, not always highly rated either by literary scholars or by historians, we actually see kind of funny things which tell us a lot about stereotypes and social status. Yeah, and it's very appropriate that popcorn is also a maize-based dish, just like Romanian Mamaliga. Yeah.
And yeah, so Mamaliga comes from maize, but you mentioned earlier maize is not European. And it first comes to Europe in the pockets of Christopher Columbus in 1493. But how does it then get to Spain, from Spain to the lands we now call Romania?
That's a fascinating and really complex question. Yeah, And maize is kind of one of the most widespread crops in the world today. If we look at statistics over the recent decades, we can see it's kind of overtaking rice. You know, it's taking a march on the potato. You know, maize is ubiquitous in the modern world. The modern world could not run without maize. Yeah. So a lot of people have tried to figure out this question. Yeah. There have been some Colombo skeptics, we might call them, who even argue that maize arrived before 1492, somewhere on the coast of West Africa where the Portuguese found it. You know, that's a kind of wacky theory which people come up with. If you put maize history into Amazon, you will be referred to a book which suggests that the ancient Egyptians had maize. You know, that's a bit on the kind of loony fringe of maize history studies. But the consensus now is, in fact, that Columbus did bring maize for the first time to Europe in 1493. Yeah. What happened next is really hard to figure out. You know, we see it growing in southern Spain, in Andalusia. We have some references to it in Rome. Yeah. Other people argue lots of different routes. Yeah. So some people argue that it didn't, in fact, travel across the Mediterranean in the 16th century, but round the coast of Africa. And it was brought by merchants through the Red Sea to Cairo, and from Cairo to Istanbul, and from Istanbul to the Balkans. You know, remarkable speculative theory. Very, very little evidence for it. Yeah. And still, you know, even in my first chapters, you know, I was very keen to solve this problem. In fact, I spent most of my time questioning existing theories. But we do find maize in the early 17th century with fairly you know, clear indications that what is being talked about is maize in northern Transylvania, in northern Moldavia, yeah, part of the eastern region of contemporary Romania, and then towards the end of the 17th century in the southern regions of Wallachia. Yeah. So really, I have to say, I didn't provide a definitive solution to this problem. But one thing I was sure of was that it wasn't introduced by formal decree. Yeah. Lots of people imagine history functioning in terms of, let us say, a leader, you know, a Sultan Suleiman the Magnificent or Emperor Rudolf, the Habsburg Emperor in the late 16th century, issuing a decree that maize should be planted, you know, just like some kind of 16th century Donald Trump having a great idea. You know, this is probably not how it worked. Yeah, and all I could do really was to collate the earliest mentions and speculate according to context. We have merchants in the Adriatic who quite likely played a significant role. They were connected with Venice. Venice in turn was connected with Iberia. Yeah. We also have evidence in Central Europe. So we find maize in Prague and Vienna towards the end of the 16th century, usually in elite botanical collections or herbariums, yeah, or herbal books. Herbal books are nice because you actually get a picture and then you can be sure it's maize. Yeah. So really it appears in little corners of Ottoman Europe at slightly funny stages. And we're dependent also on, you know, people's interest in maize. And I think people really weren't very interested in maize until quite late. You know, it was clearly being used, but the degree to which the authorities noticed it is often hard to interpret.
Yeah, there's the challenge of when something's everywhere, why bother mentioning that it exists?
Yeah, it's like camels in Arabic sources. Never mention the camels because everybody knows they're there. Yeah.
One of the best clues we've got that maize became socially important in the 18th century is that rulers started taxing it and making laws about it. How and when did maize enter the law books?
Yeah, that's a good question too, Roland. Thank you. Yeah. Before I answer, I'm just going to sketch a little bit. Maybe your viewers, your listeners are not all totally familiar with the complex kind of history of the early modern Balkans. Yeah. In short, you know, this is a period of confrontation sometimes viewed as hostility between Christian and Muslim empires, between the Habsburgs and the Ottomans. Yeah, there's frequent wars between these two great powers in this period. Yeah, but it's also a period a little bit of cultural exchange. Yeah, and the lands we're dealing with north of the Danube, Wallachia, Moldavia, and Transylvania had a little bit of a kind of ambiguous status between these two great empires. They were ruled by Christian princes. They were what we call tributary to the Ottomans. In other words, they had to make payments, usually in kind, to the Turks. So they handed over sheep or timber or wax and so forth. But they also played a part as intermediaries between these empires. So you have Hungarians in Transylvania. You have a strong Hungarian elite there. You have an Orthodox Christian elite in Wallachia and Moldavia. Yeah. And they're very much kind of between these two empires. Yeah. But also in these provinces in this period, you start to get the development of legal institutions, courts, diets in Transylvania, something resembling a modern parliament, yeah, and decrees, you know, princely decrees. So you do see Mays cropping up in these kind of documents, you know, towards the end of the 17th century. Yeah. There's a particularly interesting case in Transylvania, where, as I say, the elite population was largely Hungarian-speaking nobility, yeah, and the peasantry was largely Romanian-speaking, you know, and often excluded from the legal privileges enjoyed by the Hungarians and also by the German-speaking Saxon population of Transylvania. Yeah. And there's several mentions which come in decrees issued by the Transylvanian Diet saying that the Wallachian peasants are not allowed to grow maize, yeah, partly because it interrupts the orderly three-field system, which is the basis of medieval and early modern agriculture. Yeah. So if you like, the first mention of maize is negative. You know, this is something outside the existing social order. The Wallachians are using it to evade. They're growing it outside the village bounds. They're, you know, not paying their taxes on maize and so forth. Yeah. And remarkably, we get, you know, similar decrees in Moldavia also around the 1690s, where a new prince is appointed and he comes in and he starts to issue a tax on maize. Yeah. And this is very unpopular with the population. Everyone says, what a silly thing to do. You know, everyone has maize. Maize should be something that's kind of for free. You know, people are growing it under the forests, according to the documents. Yeah. End of the 17th century, after this kind of mysterious period where we're not quite sure, you know, who has maize, because people are not interested in it, the legislators do start to take an interest in it, you know, and they use it as a form of social control, you know, to say, you know, we are the ones, you know, who decide what can and cannot be grown in this province. You know, we are the ones who decide what should be taxed. Yeah. People should not live outside the law. You know? And through this, we actually get a glimpse of, you know, the fact that people were living a little bit outside authority. And this is something that's also been observed of maize in other parts of the world, in Africa and Indonesia. James Scott, in his book, The Art of Not Being Governed, refers to maize as an escape crop. People can grow it in the highlands of Indonesia, you know, far away from the reaches of government. You know, they can live on it without having to necessarily, you know, go to the city or, you know, engage with the authorities in any way. Yeah. And to some extent, that is a little bit the picture that we get in, not just in Southeast Asia, but in Southeast Europe. You know, maize is the escape crop. You know, this is people's safety valve. This is their way out of taxation and oppression. But we only really get this view, you know, through the laws that are made against it. We get very few statements, you know, what the peasants themselves thought of maize. Yeah.
You make the point in the book that at various times in history, Mazen Mamaliga was associated with particular social classes, like the Wallachians are growing it in order, well, sort of against the Hungarian or Austrian rulers' wishes. And so it's associated with different ethnic groups and different social classes. You've told us a bit about how it functions in Romanian culture already. Can you say something about the Roma relationship with maize?
Thank you, Roland. Yeah, again, a very interesting question. Yeah, just again to provide a bit of context, looking at what happens in the Balkans in the 18th century, so that I can kind of place your question a little bit more accurately and also help listeners maybe who aren't specialized in the region. Yeah. 18th century Balkans. You know, this is a period when the conflicts between the different empires of the region come to the boil, if you may excuse a Mamaliga metaphor, applied to historical developments. So we have the Ottomans and the Habsburgs, and we have also the rise of Russia in the 18th century and the first military conflicts between the Ottomans and the Russians. This is a phenomenon which will last for two or three centuries in the Balkans. Yeah, we get a situation where the government of these provinces starts to become very important to the surrounding empires. Yeah. And what's interesting, in fact, is that these empires don't actually seek to, in most cases, literally colonize these territories. They all have a little bit of an interest in maintaining a kind of buffer zone between them. Yeah. So this is a kind of interstitial place, if you like. Yeah. So you have Ottoman, Habsburg, and Russian empires, as we call them today, fighting over this space. But then you have a lot of intermediary layers of power. Now, I've mentioned the Hungarian nobility in Transylvania. Yeah, in Moldavia and Wallachia, you have a Greek-speaking nobility in the 18th century. Yeah, and then you have the Romanian people. Yeah, the Romanian people achieve elite status in Moldavia and Wallachia, but not so in Transylvania. Yeah, so again, you have this kind of intermediary life. Yeah, on the confines of empire at empire's edge. Yeah. But you also have all kinds of different ethnic groups. You have Armenian traders, you know, you have Serbian pig merchants, you have some Bulgarian cultivators, you have Albanians in this region as well, often serving as military guards in the courts in Bucharest and Iași in Moldavia. And kind of at the bottom of this social pyramid. I hesitate to call it a pyramid. It's more like some kind of very complex polyhedron of kind of social relations, very difficult to describe, are the Roma people. Yeah. Now, the Roma or gypsies, today they're often seen as a denigrated people or by some people romanticized. But effectively, in Wallachia and Moldavia, they were enslaved. Yeah. So they were slaves held by the princes, by the nobles of these territories called boyars. They would own slaves. And also the monasteries, the Orthodox monasteries of this region, would be slave owners in this region. Yeah. And so possibly up to about 10% of the population. Very difficult to get accurate population calculations for the early period. There are Roma gypsy slaves. Yeah. And we kind of glimpse them, particularly in monastery documents from the 18th century. Occasionally, they're referred to as working with maize. It's not kind of in the traditional repertoire of Roma gypsy professions, often seen as kind of not involved in agriculture. But Roma people did perform agricultural labor. There's a specific category, in fact, called Tsigan de Ogor, which might translate as field gypsies who carried out this work. We also have reference to Roma gypsy slaves acting as guards for maize stores. Yeah. So you have kind of quite a little bit of a Roma involvement with maize. Yeah. And it's not necessarily the kind of relationship that you would see, for instance, in the U.S. South, where the African-American slaves would be associated very directly with, say, cotton and sugar, the plants that they performed backbreaking labor to grow in enslaved conditions. So it's not necessarily that kind of relation. Yeah. But what's very interesting, and particularly looking at the cultural sources, is that many of them do associate Mamaliga with Roma gypsies. Yeah. Just to give a couple of examples here, some of the sources which start to codify national cuisine in Romania were published already in the 19th century. So we have a cookbook by the Romanian nation builder, Mihail Cogălnicianu, also a very distinguished foreign minister and politician and historian, yeah, also published a cookbook. Yeah. What's curious is that in the cookbook, he does not mention mamaliga. It's not a characteristic Romanian dish for him. Yeah. But he also published one of the first ethnographic works related to the Roma gypsies. And in this work, he describes their characteristic food to be mamaliga. Yeah. So mamaliga, or this maize porridge, is associated not only with the Romanian people, but also with the Roma gypsies. Yeah. And this is something that comes through also in folklore and in popular songs as well, yeah, that mamaliga might possibly be a characteristic Roma food. Yeah. That's actually an argument which I mentioned very frequently in the book, but I would like to develop a little bit more. It's not, you know, my central argument, but I think it's interesting to see how mamaliga as a dish, you know, might not just be a Romanian cultural symbol, but also have associations with Roma and occasionally also with other ethnic groups as well.
Yeah, particularly with poverty.
Yeah, but I think that's a good point. It's kind of mamaliga, maybe like porridge, you know, is seen as a subsistence food. You know, it is the kind of, just maybe as the Roma, the kind of bottom layer of society. So mamaliga, both literally and socially, is the bottom layer of subsistence. You know, if you have mamaliga, you can survive. Yeah, you will eat. You will not be rich. You will not be well esteemed. But it's a kind of it's at the bottom of things.
The holidays have arrived early with Blinds.com's Spring Black Friday sale. Upgrading window coverings can be a minor project with a major impact. Blinds.com makes it easy and affordable. Browse premium blinds, shades, shutters. We have your patio covered too. And get unlimited window treatments installed for one low cost. Free shipping and Blinds.com's 100% satisfaction guarantee. Shop Blinds.com's Spring Black Friday sale now. Save up to 45% plus premium doorbusters. Up to 45% off at Blinds.com. Rules and restrictions may apply.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code SPOTIFY to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code SPOTIFY at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code SPOTIFY.
Yeah, but it nonetheless has a lot of uses in the 18th century. You describe people using it to make alcohol, to get sugar from, and we even see maize being smuggled out of Wallachia into Transylvania and Bukovina against the wishes of the authorities. Why do you think it was that maize was so versatile?
That's a good question as well. Yeah. I mean, a simple answer, which is quite often given in popular writing about mamaliga, actually has a kind of kernel of truth to it. You know, so if you read a kind of popular newspaper article on our national food, why do we eat mamaliga in Romania? Yeah, people will say because the Turks didn't take it. Yeah. And there's, you know, there's a little bit of truth in that, actually, and it's true not only of the Ottomans but also the Habsburgs and the Russians. If you do 18th century history of this region, you're very dependent on foreign sources and you know, surveys of economic conditions written in different languages. Irrespective of whether they're written by Russians, you know, Austrians or Turks, tend to have a kind of negative attitude towards maize. Yeah. So again, I have, say, an Austrian report saying Mama Liga is what the bureaucrat calls in German a defekt. Yeah. It's a poor food. Yeah. Or I have, again, an Austrian administrator complaining that, you know, the Romanians are growing maize everywhere and not sticking to kind of orderly field boundaries and so forth. Yeah. So there's obviously a kind of negative attitude towards maize on the part of the different neighboring imperial authorities. Yeah. So, yeah, I think, you know, sometimes popular stories have a grain of truth to them. And maize obviously was used by people living on the margins of society, also literally on the geographical boundaries between empires. The basic kind of Ottoman frontier, Ottoman-Habsburg frontier, is coincides with the Carpathian Mountains circling Transylvania. Yeah. So you get people living in the uplands of these mountains, not exactly on the peaks, but, you know, halfway up the hill. Yeah. You also have a pastoral economy. There are shepherds from Transylvania who travel every year across the Carpathians and across the Wallachian plain down to the lower Danube, the banks of the Danube, which is very fertile, very rich terrain. Yeah. So we have a little bit of movement across this imperial frontier, if you like. Yeah. These people clearly start to valorize maize in the second half of the 18th century. Yeah. As I say, we're often dependent on consular reports, but we also get more local documentation. And we see people using maize in different ways. Yeah. So although the book is called The Making of Mama Liga, it could be about the making of other things. Yeah. So in late 18th century Moldavia on the Polish border, you start to get the development of alcohol production on a larger scale. There's traditional alcohol production made of fruit, you know, since time immemorial. But people also work out that they can make alcohol out of maize. You know, this is the kind of Jack Daniels of the lower Danube, if you like. You know? And they can also make money for it. They can commercialize alcohol. Yeah. So the Christian Orthodox elites of the region start to get interested in maize if they can make it to sell alcohol, to sell to the peasants, or sell across the frontier into Poland or into Russia. You know, they're onto something. Yeah. They also use it for fodder. Yeah. Now, today in the world, you know, two thirds or even three quarters of maize production is destined for animal fodder. Yeah. In earlier times, that wasn't the case. You know, it was mainly eaten by humans. But people also work out that they can fatten their pigs better on maize than they can on acorns. Yeah. And we see this going on as well. Yeah. We also see some of these kind of trans-border people, you know, whether they're shepherds or whether they're bandits or whether they're merchants, you know, taking maize from one province to another. You know, they know where there's plenty of maize. They know where maize is scarce. They know that they can profit from this in a little way. Yeah. This is also a continued period of regular warfare between the Russians and the Ottomans and also the Habsburgs. Yeah. So if you can sell maize to an army, you can do well. Yeah. Unfortunately, the Russians really do not like maize very much at all. So you're not going to make much money selling maize to, you know, they say it's very, very bad for the stomach, these Moldavian cakes. You know, we like to eat rye bread. You know. You know, in this kind of inter-imperial space, which you think of maybe as a space of disorder, you start to get these kind of economic activities, which, you know, again, they kind of provide structure to the economy, and they enable some people to grow rich. And we're leading up to the period of the national revolts in the 19th century. You know, sometimes said that in neighboring Serbia, the national revolt was instigated by pig traders, you know, who had prospered on the Ottoman-Habsburg frontier. And a little bit the same in Wallachia, you get pig traders, but also maize traders. You know, some of the Wallachian elite of the 19th century, you know, really do owe their wealth to this kind of approach to maize that they could commercialize it and they could do, you know, new things with it, and they could change their social status. Yeah. You can make big claims about this, you know, and big claims have been made. The American historian William McNeil, who's a very distinguished historian of the potato, but also written about what he called Europe's steppe frontier. You know, he claimed that maize, you know, enabled the population to live well, you know, outside of authority, and even that this changed the balance of power in the Balkans. You know, this was kind of almost the origin of the Balkan national revolutions. You know, now that's a bit of a, you know, stick your neck out claim, you know, but in some ways I think it's nice to entertain these claims and look at them in detail. You know, I'm not saying that, you know, Mamaliga caused Romanian national independence, but there is some truth in saying that maize, you know, did change social relations in these borderland regions.
And you do have some evidence for that. You talk about the 1821 uprisings and the 1888 peasant revolt and the 1907 peasant uprising, and you show that maize is omnipresent. It's wherever you turn in those uprisings, you see maize appearing. Thinking just about 1821 and Alexander Ypsilanti's revolt, can you tell us how did maize help Ypsilanti rebel against the Ottomans?
Okay, so it's like how maize changed the world. Yeah, you know, this is the popular historian's claim. Yeah. This point was actually raised in quite an entertaining but also serious article published in the 1980s about conditions in Ceausescu's Romania. Yeah. Stephen Sampson, who was an American-trained anthropologist, was trying to explain to himself in that period, you know, why there seemed to be very, very little sign of political resistance in Ceausescu's Romania. There was no solidarity movement. There was no Charter 77. The people seemed like Mamaliga to him. You know, and his article is called "Muddling Through in Romania" or "Why the Mamaliga Doesn't Explode." So that was his kind of very witty but also pertinent phrase for a social analysis of conditions under late socialism. So just before the famous Romanian revolution of 1989. Yeah. And this phrase actually got picked up, you know, and there are even books now in Romanian called, you know, "Why the Mamaliga Exploded," you know, or looking at interpretations of the Romanian Revolution using this metaphor. Yeah. So I think it's worth mentioning that this is a kind of common figure of speech, well, not universally known, but kind of quite widespread figure of speech to refer to social change in Romania, the exploding Mamaliga. Yeah. So it's when the nation finally kind of comes up in revolt. Yeah. Romania, as you mentioned, has this history of rebellion and revolt going back to the 19th century to 1821, which is kind of beginning of the end of Ottoman rule, marked by a simultaneous rebellion led by, on the one hand, a Greek nobleman called Prince Alexander Ypsilanti, and by a Romanian free peasant called Tudor Vladimirescu. Yeah. And this revolt has been studied hundreds of times. And we heard a lot about it last year in 2021 because it was the bicentenary. Yeah. Now, many of these interpretations are looking at, you know, whether this was a Greek revolt, you know, or whether it was a Romanian peasant revolt. The two leaders, the Greek nobleman and the Romanian peasant, actually end up coming into conflict with each other. Ypsilanti has the Greek Ypsilanti has the Romanian Vladimirescu killed on his orders, but then his own rebellion is a disaster. But this is kind of the beginning of the building of the national state, not just in Romania but also in Greece and other parts of the Balkans. Yeah. So reading a lot of this stuff and rereading it, particularly last year, you know, I thought, well, you know, how can we get an alternative interpretation? You know, does it have to just be a story of kind of elites versus peasants or Greeks versus Romanians? You know, and we had this a little bit these stereotyped views of people involved in national uprisings in the 19th century Some of them are intellectuals, you know, some of them are merchants, some of them are bandits, some of these are peasants. And what struck me researching, you know, primary documents on this topic is that a lot of figures who might actually fit all those categories, you know, so someone like Tudor Vladimirescu is a free peasant born in the west of Wallachia near the Habsburg border in 1780. Yeah. Despite being born into a peasant family, he rises in the social hierarchy. He acts as bailiff to one of the local boyars. He becomes quite well educated. He can write not just in Romanian, but in Greek and German. Yeah. One of the things he does write about is maize. You know, he is trading maize, you know, both across the Danube to the Ottomans, but also across the Carpathians into Habsburg lands. Yeah. So if we want to ask ourselves the question, you know, how did these people have partly the courage, but also the power, the economic resources, in order to stage an uprising at this point? On the one hand, they partly have the support of foreign powers, or they claim to have the support of foreign powers such as Russia, which it turns out they didn't have the support they needed. But they do have maize, you know, and they also want maize. You know, when Ypsilanti's army comes into Moldavia in 1821, there are explicit instructions to gather maize. You know, he needs it to feed his army, you know, but also to make sure it doesn't get into other people's hands. You know, Vladimirescu may be trading maize with the Ottomans at the same time that he's rebelling against them. But you find it in documents. It's a complicated story. I can't quite tell it in a short answer to a podcast. But it's another example of how something like maize, you know, can actually be a historical actor in its own right. We can say, you know, was the rebellion caused by the Greek guy? Was it caused by the Romanian guy? And I'm saying, well, no, it's caused by this plant, which they're all really interested in. Yeah. And even the Ottoman Turks at this stage start to get interested in maize. You know? They start to take tribute in maize, which they'd never done before. You know? There are Ottoman traders who come to the Danube, to the towns of Galați and Brăila, in order to load up ships to provision the capital city of Istanbul. Yeah. And we see them buying up maize in the 1810s and 1820s like they've never done before. Yeah. And the Ottomans are also feeding their armies on maize, which again is something we don't have reference before. You know. So at this moment, you know, this decisive moment in modern history, when we start to get the move from imperial power to independent national states, you know, maize is at the heart of the story.
So after Ypsilanti's rebellion and things start to settle down, Wallachia and Moldavia then become protectorates of Russia in 1829. And one of the first things the Russians were interested in when they took over was maize. How did maize help consolidate Russian control of the principalities?
Yeah, this is again the next phase, if you like, in Romanian national development. Now, after this period of disorder and rebellion in the 1820s, then principalities of Moldavia and Wallachia are put under Russian protection. And there's a very able Russian general who comes in, Pavel Kiselyov, who effectively kind of reorganizes the administration of this space. Yeah. He creates a quarantine along the Danube. You know, he creates a stable frontier. So you know, Ottoman subjects are not allowed to enter these territories without permission. There's very extensive reorganization of social relations in the village. The peasants are divided into different social categories. Basically, agriculture is extended. Yeah. And a little bit, this is with a view to export. Yeah. Sometimes people date the origins of capitalism in Romania to this date, 1829, yeah, when free commerce is permitted out of the Danube and through the Black Sea Straits. So, yeah, this is kind of a key point in territorialization, sedentarization, yeah, hierarchization of, you know, confirmation of, if you like, a kind of late feudal social structure, the boyars, the peasants, and the middle class, you know, the development of cities, Bucharest and Iași are growing cities at this point, you know, Bucharest exceeds 100,000 in population. You know, it's the largest, by far the largest city in southeastern Europe, between Istanbul and Buda. No city is, you know, of a comparable size in the Balkans. Yeah. Now, particularly with a view to export, Russia is, of course, developing its own grain trade at this point through the recently founded city of Odessa on the north of the Black Sea. Yeah. And in fact, Russian exports of wheat are of quite some significance for the development of extended commercial networks supplying cities in the northern Mediterranean. Export from Odessa through Trieste, through Genoa, through Marseille, you know, plays a not insignificant, you know, role in European development at this point. Yeah. As such, you know, they're also concerned that although the principalities should grow and export maize, they shouldn't compete with the Russian effort. This is actually a very actual topic. You know, you see a whole kind of set of debates today about export of grain from the Black Sea. But if the principalities can export maize, they would not be in competition with the export of grain from the Russian steppes. Yeah. Nevertheless, the Russians do make some efforts to obstruct commerce. There's a series of kind of quite heated diplomatic exchanges between the British authorities and the Russian authorities as to the navigability of the Danube Delta. The British accused the Russians of trying to silt it up and failing to make it navigable, and you know, actually, you know, not acting in, you know, the principles of free commerce, you know, which the British tried to promote. And this has been the subject of a very interesting book by a colleague in Bucharest, Constantin Ardelianu, who's written about navigation on the Danube in the 19th century and its importance for international law, but its also importance for the international and indeed the world economy at this point. Yeah. So, yeah, this is a period of incipient capitalism, development of really extensive agriculture, yeah, designed for commercial purposes for export. Because the funny thing, under the Turks, then under the Ottomans, cereals were not really at the center of export from these territories. It's really when the Russians come in and you start to get this kind of proto-capitalist system that you get, not if you like plantation agriculture. You know, some people could even make comparisons to, you know, plantation economies of rubber or cotton or coffee in other parts of the world. But you really get a kind of maize-centric economy, or certainly a cereal-centric economy at this point. And it's an object of contestation between the great powers all the way up until the period of independence in 1878.
Apart from the fact that the British are everywhere in the 19th century, it sounds weird to talk about the British getting involved in Eastern Europe. And in the book, you make a point that it was really quite suddenly in the 1840s that Britain kind of discovered the Romanian lands. What was it about Romania in the 1840s that got the British interested in going there?
Yeah, that's a good question. I've kind of sketched this picture where before this period, the main, you know, foreign observers and envoys who come to this region are not the Brits. You know, that it's definitely one place where the Brits didn't come first. You know, so you have, there are many British travelers in earlier periods, but the important ones are really obviously the imperial powers themselves, the Ottomans and the Habsburgs. You know, they have administrators and explorers and so forth. But you have Russian observers. You start to get consulates set up in the late 18th century. The Prussians take an interest under Frederick the Great. You know, there are even Neapolitan and Sardinian envoys. You know, everyone's kind of looking to this region thinking, you know, this is a very fertile part of the world. You know, what can be done to improve it? You know, and this is a little bit the period of Europeanization, you know, not just in culture and language and literature, but also in economy. Yeah. Now, the Brits come to this a little bit late. You know, their main concerns are not primarily in the Balkans. They're interested in the Mediterranean. They're interested in the Indian Ocean. You know, they have developed their imperial networks in India, but also in the Atlantic, in Latin America, and so forth. You know, this is initially quite a kind of secondary part of the world. Yeah. And I think, you know, they get interested in it partly for the reasons of inter-imperial competition, which I've tried to outline already, the conflict with the Russians. But they also get interested in it for a curious reason. This is the 1840s is, of course, a period of famine, not just in Ireland, but also in many parts of Western Europe. And the British government famously did very little to relieve the famine in Ireland in 1846 and 1847. But one thing they did do was try to convince the Irish to eat maize when there were no potatoes. And maize was imported, first of all, from the United States, but then also from the lower Danube region. So we have Moldavian and Wallachian maize reaching Ireland at this point. Yeah. The policy was a total disaster. The Irish refused to eat what they called, after the name of the then British Prime Minister, Robert Peel, they called it Peel's brimstone, yeah, because of the yellow colour of the maize. Yeah. And that's actually an example of a kind of imperial policy where people are using maize, or imperial powers are using maize, not as an escape crop, but almost as a kind of a crop to give to the subaltern population. Yeah. And you see this in other parts of the world. So in the US South at this period, slave owners use maize to feed their slaves. Yeah. So the slaves in the US South, they grow cotton, they grow sugar, but they are fed on maize. Yeah. The British did try to do the same with the Irish. Yeah. The British tried to do the same with convicts in Australia. Yeah. Who were fed maize, you know, until the 1840s, emancipation. The first thing the convicts do when they're emancipated is stop eating maize. They don't like it.
So this book finishes in the early 20th century after the 1907 uprising. And it finishes with a couple of chapters on the place of maize in Romanian folklore, literature, and recipe books. And you point out there's almost no recipes for mamaliga in Romanian cookbooks that are written for Romanians, but that cookbooks written for foreigners about Romanian cooking, mamaliga is everywhere, and it's front, you know, it's the most important thing you want to tell about foreigners. What does this tell us about the cultural meanings of maize, do you think?
Yeah, again, this is a very interesting question. Yeah, I was looking not just at the kind of political economy of maize, which I've talked about hitherto, but also, you know, the cultural representations of maize. In fact, I kind of started from that question, trying to pick out, you know, what mamaliga might mean to people. Yeah. And there are some recipes for mamaliga. I should contextualize a little bit. So in the mid-19th century, you know, you get a literary nation-building process, just as you get in other countries in East Central Europe and in Western Europe as well. Things get codified as national. Yeah. So again, in Scotland, we have the tartan, we have the porridge, we have the shortbread. You know, we have a codification of everyday culture. You know, involving, you know, not just works of high literature, but also food and clothing, music, and so forth. Yeah. Cooking is no exception. So in the 1840s, you get the first Romanian cookbooks. Yeah, we do have one Romanian recipe from 1849 by in a cookbook by a woman called Maria Maurer, of whom we know very little about her. She published a cookbook with the simple title Cookbook, or Carte de Bucate in Romanian. And she publishes a recipe for mamaliguța, yeah, little mamaliga, if you like. Yeah. But this appears to be a translation of a foreign recipe. And in no cookbook that I found was mamaliga given a prominent place. So you do get it mentioned here and there. And in the 1910s, 1920s, and 1930s, you get kind of large-sized, complete cookery manuals, you know, sometimes used, in fact, not just in the home, but in schools to promote domestic economy. Yeah. So this would be the kind of incorporation of women's labor into the kind of national effort in a more formal way, you know, so how you should keep house as a good Romanian. How you should wash clothes, you know, and so forth, but also how, you know, how you should cook. So there's kind of encyclopedic works by reputed authors, Sanda Marin, for example, Ekaterina Komša, the kind of repertoire of cookbooks, which has been quite well studied by previous scholars. You do get Mamaliga in these kind of works, but really kind of it's never signaled as prominent. You know, it sort of appears on page 357 in a separate section, you know, three or four recipes for Mamaliga. Yeah. But national identity functions, I think, not just through transmission inwards, you know, to spreading, if you like, the kind of codification of Mamaliga to the people, you know, what is a correct Mamaliga, you know, how to eat it properly, you know, but also outwards. Yeah. So you see in sources like Romanian contributions to world exhibitions, you know, these are kind of great showcases for national identity in the 19th century, attended by huge numbers of people, you know, eager to learn about the new, or to them, new nationalities of Eastern Europe. So you will find the Romanian Pavilion in 1889 at the Universal Exhibition in Paris. If you were able to go there with a time machine and order some food at the Romanian Cabaret as a visitor to that exhibition, you would get Mamaliga. You would be served Mamaliga. Yeah. And you get the same thing in a series of exhibitions in 1938. There's again a major world exhibition, and the Romanians translate a cookbook. And here Mamaliga is kind of page one. Yeah. And that's something you still see today. So, you know, many Romanian cookbooks, you know, but it's kind of changed a little bit, Mamaliga. It's become a little bit more of a side dish, you know. So if you go to a fancy restaurant in Bucharest, you can certainly order Mamaliga. Sometimes as a starter, maybe with white cheese or cream, sometimes with eggs. Mamaliga goes very well with dairy. Yeah. But sometimes as a side dish, just as you would have chips on the side, you would have, instead of that, you would have Mamaliga on the side, you know. So it kind of fits into a more Europeanized, you know, main dish as an accompaniment to lamb or pork or so forth. Yeah. But so it gets kind of a little bit sentimentalized or branded in general kind of international production of cookbooks for an international audience. But in the domestic repertoire, you know, it's not always there, you know, and I was actually quite puzzled by this absence. You know, do people want to hide the Mamaliga? You know, I would rather be eating something better. You know, this is not something important to us, you know. Or is it part of a kind of a submerged cultural code? Or is it something that's so obvious? And as I said, I think, you know, from a technical point of view, Mamaliga doesn't require a huge amount of instructions. You know, is it worth putting it in a cookbook? Or is that kind of something that's always there, kind of in the background, which doesn't require, you know, to be explained? You know, would you serve it on a feast day? Would you serve it at a wedding? Or would you? Is this just your everyday food, which you'd rather, in fact, avoid on kind of festive or important occasions? Yeah. I didn't totally get to the bottom of this puzzle, I would say, you know, and it's very tempting, I think, if you're doing this kind of cultural anthropology of cookbooks, you know, to codify too much, to kind of read too much into it, you know, to say, you know, this is what it's like at elite level, this is what it's like at peasant level, this is what the foreigners think, this is what the local people think, you know. But there are definite patterns there, you know, and one of these patterns is, I think, the presence of Mamaliga in international branding, but its absence in, or its reduced presence in domestic publications.
That's really interesting. And you've shown us how useful maize is for thinking the history of the 17th and 18th centuries and also 19th century. I've seen a lot of these events for the first time through fresh eyes, hearing about the way that maize functions in uprisings and in occupation regimes. And as a historian of the 20th century, I really hope that we'll see a sequel that brings us at least to the fall of communism, if not later. But thank you very much for your comments today, Alex.
Thanks a lot, Roland. I really appreciate it. Yeah, I think there could be an opportunity to write not the making, but the breaking of Mamaliga. And it does, I think, play a very important role in World War One. There's been some good work on consumer culture. There's a PhD at the Central European University by a scholar called Skrob. Lucian Skrob has written about In fact, the decline of Mamaliga, which really takes place remarkably late in the second half of the 20th century. People want to eat bread. People give up Mamaliga a little bit, So that's a very good consumer study, but also its actual role in the economy and export and so forth, and looking maybe, studying the rise of far-right movements in the interwar period or, the place of communist Romania in Comecon, in the international economy of the of the Eastern Bloc, really kind of, moving a little bit away from individual actors and looking at social processes, I think that would be a fun project. But I finished on the eve of World War One, because I think maybe the reader has enough to eat by that stage. So we can take a break and come back to eat more Mamaliga, maybe at a later stage.
Nice. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Roland.